Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. We are glad to be here today. My name is Ruth Naomi Floyd. I've been involved in HIV work and AIDS care for about 15 years in the Philadelphia area. Started out with Hope Ministry, which was a ministry that was born out of Harvest and under the auspices of and blessing of 10th Presbyterian Church. And then about 5 years ago, came to work with Esperanza Health Center and the Hope team there. And so really have been blessed for 10 of those years to work, particularly the end stage, death and dying, the last season of a person's life living with HIV and full-blown AIDS. And then at Esperanza, really doing a lot of prevention testing in other areas too. So today we're going to do two parts. I think it's really important to understand the disease, and we have, I think, one of the world's best teachers on and educators on the basics and fundamentals of HIV/AIDS, Rob Reich. Well, I've had the privilege of working, thank you, by the way, for sharing. I have had the privilege of working with Rob at Esperanza Health Center located in Philadelphia at Kay and Allegheny, at Kay and Kensington and Allegheny, and 5th Street right off of Cambria. And he is just a great man of God, a great educator, and I think for his brilliance is equal or is surpassed only by his humility in the care and mercy that he gives the patients. While working there, I was working with the Hope team, and we worked with the difference that I had clients and he had more patients, but there were times when our patients and clients intersected, and just to see the impact that his life and ministry and presence has had on the lives and the family of people affected and infected with HIV has been really a beautiful example of what we're to be light in the world. So I'm going to have Rob tell a little bit of his background. He has a really interesting background. And then to go ahead and share about the basics of HIV care. And then we'll come back and talk about the mercy aspect of how to mobilize, how to strengthen, and how to sit at the feet of someone with HIV and AIDS, and how to bring the gift of Jesus into their lives.
That's brought to mean hope.
Yes.
You love saying that word, don't you? I love listening to you say it. I can tell you're really enjoying
yes,
that word.
I do.
Say again.
Esperanza.
It's great. As Ruth said, I've been working at Esperanza for the last 7 years, specifically in HIV AIDS, part of our clinic. And I grew up in Ecuador as a missionary kid. I never would have dreamed if you had told me way back when that that's what I'd be doing. And it's been really, it's neat to see God's hand in where he directs us in our lives. I'm a physician assistant. I went to school just down the road here at Arcadia. And I'm also an HIV specialist. You can become a specialist in this subject, and I've done that. So the part of my talk here is to really give you a medical overview of HIV, because a lot of the misunderstanding of HIV comes down to what's going on physiologically, and the history of where did it come from. A lot of these things have practical implications in terms of, there's lots of theories out there of where HIV came from in terms of it's a plot from the government. So knowing a lot of those things, it's really helpful to provide the basis. And Ruth is going to explain some more about a lot of the heart and mercy. So we have like over 200 slides. There's no way we're going to get through those. So I really want to focus a lot on areas that you have medical questions regarding HIV and the care of HIV medications, a lot of those things. Since it's a smaller group, we can maybe really focus on those things. So I'm going to get started. And if you have a question, just go ahead and interrupt me, and we'll focus on those areas. So it's always good to start from the basics, and then we can go forward. So very basically, what does HIV stand for?
Human immunodeficiency virus.
That's right. That's a pretty big mouthful. This is a micrograph picture of a virus. And the title says a lot. What is immunodeficiency?
The immune system doesn't work.
Right.
Deficiency of
Right, exactly. And it's a virus. So those are two good things to keep in mind as we go forward. And where does it come from? What have you heard in terms of where does HIV come from?
I can tell you one I heard. My kids brought it up. My kids know more about this than I do because they teach a lot of this in the public school that they go to. But they were told that it's a fallacy, that it comes from a man and an ape getting together.
A man and an ape getting together.
That's what,
but it's
that
a
was,
fallacy.
That was what was going okay. on, but they came home and told me that that's a fallacy.
Okay.
That's not true.
Okay. But it's not true that that's where it occurred.
Yeah, that's what they said.
Okay. What else have you heard in terms of where it comes from?
Heard it came from monkeys, but not necessarily a man and monkey.
Okay.
Yeah, I read something like that, similar to that. Yeah.
Okay.
That it was a monkey disease that somehow transferred over to humans.
Okay. Does it sound believable?
There's stuff like that that happens in China. Like in the marketplaces where they have a lot of animals that are like exotic and close together, like I know that that's happening in China.
Trans-species.
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
I think the bird flu.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That seems like a good possibility.
So, it is true. In 1999, which is not that long ago, this has been around for a while, they proved, so to speak, that HIV-1, because there's different types of HIV, resulted from a cross-species transmission, just like you mentioned, the marketplaces in China, from SIV, which is simian immunodeficiency virus, which is very common in several different species of primates in West Africa. The SIV virus does not affect the primates the way it affects humans, and just in similar ways that those viruses don't affect some of those animals that they're in before they jump species. It has a very different effect. And there's 20 species found to be infected but seemingly unaffected by the AIDS-like virus. So let me just back up. So you said that you had your kids come home and they said that it came from a man and a chimpanzee getting together, and it was a fallacy. They don't know how the virus jumped from a primate to a human. It could have been in the butchering process. I highly doubt that it was sexual. But it happened a long time ago. They have the earliest sample, preserved sample, of HIV was from a Congolese man in 1959. This was a blood sample that was preserved while the researcher was doing research on other things. And then years later, they took that same blood sample and found it to be HIV positive. Using complex mathematical formulas, they tried it because basically the HIV virus is unlike our human cells that have proofreading genes that when they copy the DNA, or in this case the RNA, they make sure that the copy is like the original, and they just cut out areas that are wrong. There's no proofreading genes in HIV, so there's lots of changes in the copy is a little bit different. So based on that rate of change, they're able to take that sample from 1959 and other samples and sort of plot back when this trans-species contamination occurred. And would you believe that it's probably around 1930? So bottom line is HIV's been on the African continent for many, many years, and many people have died of other things without knowing that that was HIV, and it starts in a small community and spreads to others. But obviously these mathematical formulas wide confidence interval 1910-1950. So it's pretty broad, but bottom line, it's been around for a long time. So when did it come to the U.S.?
Wasn't it big in the 80s? It seemed like that was when it all growth.
So you started coming out in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. You started hearing about it. So
probably earlier than that. But.
Right. A lot of what we hear of HIV history in the United States, you might come across the story of Patient Zero. And it's when HIV was first surfacing in the early 80s, they tried to trace the contacts of a lot of the first cases and sort of find out what the common contact was. And they traced them back to a French-Canadian flight attendant, and they called him Patient Zero. So 1981, that's when this first came out, and actually it wasn't called HIV back then. It was called, they called it GRID. And they were trying to figure out what could have caused it. They thought maybe several STDs in combination, rare tropical disease. They couldn't really isolate what was going on. A lot of people looking back at that time feel like the CDC made a lot of big mistakes. One is that they pigeonholed it, and they said this is a gay disease. And if they had kept their mind open and realized that it's heterosexual, they might have been able to do a lot more earlier that would have prevented a lot of HIV. And so it wasn't until 1983, this is years. Look, if you think of 81, 82, 83, this is pretty slow for an agency to catch on that this is hemophiliacs, heterosexual. And then that's when... So, reality is, HIV arrived in the U.S. If you think of HIV being in Africa since maybe 1930, it came to the U.S. in different ways at different times. And also, HIV's been in Haiti for some time as well, so they think it could have come into the U.S. from Haiti. They think in terms of the most of HIV coming to the United States in 1968, and this really correlates with roughly a lot of people have a 10-year asymptomatic period where they don't have symptoms, and then that's with symptomatic patients coming out in the early 1980s. So throughout the spreading throughout the 70s. These are old statistics. I have to update this. It's 43 million is growing in terms of the world population of HIV positive patients. Philadelphia, where I work, definitely has quite a few times the rate of HIV than the rest of the state of the general rate of HIV in the state of Pennsylvania. But when you look worldwide, a lot of the hardest hit area is sub-Saharan Africa. Also growing in Eastern Europe, in Asia, in China. There's lots of places around the world where this is becoming, and many people would consider one of the world's biggest health crises. This is in Spanish. We've done some training in Ecuador, and I have some of these left over from that. But so you can see that Asia and Europe is growing, and this is where you have a lot of the effect. So what does AIDS stand for?
Acquired immunodeficiency syndrome.
Yeah. Very good. And so here again we have that immune deficiency idea. And something that often comes up is, what is the difference between HIV and AIDS? Are they the same thing? Are they related? Are they carriers? What's the difference between HIV and AIDS?
It's the later stages.
Yeah. HIV is the virus, and AIDS is the symptoms that show up about 10 years later.
Okay. That's very close. It's the name of the virus that causes AIDS, and AIDS is a stage. And AIDS is actually, from a medical perspective, it's very specifically defined in terms of, like, we'll get into it later, in terms of what we call our CD4 count, which is a certain number of CD4 cells in the immune system that the HIV virus infects directly, and you have to have less than 200, you have to have a specific type of infection. It's difficult to explain in the general public because it's a medical definition, but it roughly correlates with the later stages. Is there a cure? No cure?
From what I understand, there isn't.
Right. There's no cure, but it is very much treatable.
Treatable.
And the issue with a lot of places is that treatment is not available, and testing is very difficult, but it is treatable, and it is preventable. Maybe just back up at the beginning, I said if there's a specific question or from the area from a medical perspective, because we have a limited amount of time to get through this enough time. So if there's a pressing question you have, just raise your hand and we'll address it. Is HIV spread by donating blood?
Not anymore.
No. Is it spread during breastfeeding?
I think so.
Yes, no. It is.
Oh, it is.
HIV is found in certain fluids, including blood, vaginal fluid, semen, and breast milk. It's not found in saliva unless it's contaminated saliva.
Would that baby have already had it before they were breastfed anyway, or is that not necessarily true?
No. It's a very good point. One of the things that happens in the womb is that there's actually a separation where the placenta and the uterus come together, so that the baby can have, for example, a different blood type than the mom, and there's an exchange of nutrients at that place, but the blood doesn't mix necessarily. Without any treatment treating the mother, only a fourth of those children will become HIV positive. With treatments, down to 2 or 3% will become positive. Yeah. So this issue of breastfeeding is very big in the third world because there isn't formula in a lot of places, and the formula that's available is poor quality. And so sometimes in those cases, it's better to breastfeed even though there's a risk of HIV because the formula is the child dies of malnutrition. But breastfeeding does. How about?
Yes. Is the baby? Will the baby definitely get AIDS if breastfed?
Not necessarily. The issue in terms of which we'll talk about later. There's two numbers that you really need to know in terms of where that patient is in their HIV progression. One is their CD4 count, and that's the number of CD4 cells, which we'll talk about, per cubic centimeter of blood. And that count tells you where they are. And then the other thing is their viral load, how much virus they have circulating in their system. And so someone who has a very high viral load, that breast milk is going to be much more likely to transmit HIV than someone who has a very low viral load. So not all breast milk is equal depending on the viral load.
Is that true for exposure then too?
Yes. And it becomes an issue too in terms of part of what's difficult in developing countries is HIV spread more because patients are not on medications. They have high viral loads. They're much more able to transmit HIV. We have patients that come to Esperanza where one partner is positive, the other's negative, and in spite of us encouraging them to use condoms, they don't, and they don't transmit it because their viral load is very low because of medication. So your viral load makes a big difference in terms of transmissibility. What about casual contact, hugging, kissing, sharing food, shaking hands? No? Okay. This is a really big, important issue in terms of caring for HIV positive patients. Some of our patients really, really struggle with informing their family members that they're positive because like some of our patients have gotten, plastic silverware and clean the seat after they sit up, and it really is a difficult issue for a lot of them to face.
What about the sharing food? Like, what about sharing a straw? Is that something that can be transmitted through saliva?
Yeah, it's not transmitted through saliva. in typical, like I said, it's not, if they have a lot of sores in their mouth, it's possible. The CDC has done, the Centers for Disease Control has done studies on different, and there's been one or two cases of household contact getting HIV just through household contact, but in either one or both of those cases, the HIV patient had a lot of open sores and a lot of bandages and was not taking care of cleaning up those bandages. But in regular, like thousands and thousands of household contacts, just through living with a person, there isn't been cases other than those one or two of someone getting HIV by living with someone, sharing their food or eating off their plate. What about vaginal, anal, or oral sex?
Yeah.
Oral sex is something that there's still a lot of people that don't think you can get HIV through oral sex. You can get HIV through oral sex. I was sitting on a plane in Ecuador speaking to a urologist from Ecuador who didn't know that. And so it's still something that needs to be emphasized. What about tears, sweat, saliva, or urine? No. Toilet seats, towels, sharing needles, of course. Mosquitoes.
No.
Why not?
Because they've found that there aren't any cases. I don't know. I mean, it seems possible. They drink blood and they spread it, but they haven't found any cases where it's been
right.
Spread through.
That's exactly right. But it's one of those things that seems a little bit puzzling, right? If malaria, yellow fever is spread by mosquitoes, why not HIV? And they've actually even found the HIV virus in the blood of a mosquito that the mosquito has eaten. But the basic physiologic reason why mosquitoes do not transmit HIV is when a mosquito bites, when it first penetrates, it injects some of its saliva, and then it sucks the blood, and malaria and yellow fever are transmitted through that saliva of the mosquito. And it's mosquitoes do not transmit HIV. But it is a big issue in terms of prevention and in terms of people's understanding of the disease. Here in Philadelphia, we were giving in our neighborhood, a talk for pastors on HIV, and one of the pastors had this understanding that HIV is transmitted by mosquitoes. So it's something that's very important, that it has a lot of implications to pregnancy. It can be, yes, we talked about that. And what about through the ear? HIV doesn't survive very long outside the body, and this is different from other viruses. The hepatitis C virus, which is also common in North Philadelphia, it survives much longer outside the body. And so someone is much more likely to get hepatitis C by an open wound, like touching something, than HIV. You really have to, it's more body-to-body and body fluid contact that transmits HIV, depending on the viral load as well. I had someone, when they read this, say, well, why don't, you know, if this disinfectants cure HIV, why can't you just, like, drink Clorox? Well, that would kill you, too. So, yeah, there's lots of things that kill HIV that's just difficult being able to get it without getting it.
Yeah.
That slide before this one, did it say that mother to child during pregnancy?
Yes, it can.
But I thought you said that there was a break between
right. Thank you for bringing that up. What happens is when the child is going through the birth canal, there's lots in the vaginal fluid area, there tends to be more HIV. And it's so if someone does not have access to medications, a C-section is preferable, decreasing the rate of HIV transmission. Because there's as that child's going through the birth canal, that's where there's mixing of blood. So it's in the birthing process where without treatment, a fourth of them will be positive. Now, the mother's given antivirals, the baby's also given antivirals, and it's 2 or 3%. If those things happen like they should, then transmission occurs. And you can now, an HIV positive woman can now deliver naturally without a C-section with those things in place.
Do Do they test mothers before they give birth to find out if they do have?
They do. There's now, especially with the rapid test, which is it's available at Esperanza as well. Very good questions. So these are the body fluids. I put up here the best way to prevent is HIV is not to have sex before marriage. Obviously, the virus doesn't discriminate whether you're married or not. Yeah, there's a lot of personal bias in that statement. The idea is monogamy, and that's proven to be true in a lot of countries where there is a high rate. The greater the rate of the decreased number of sexual partners, the less the spread of HIV. They did a study in the country of Malawi. It's fascinating. They had a village where some university students from the United States did a huge amount of work, and I don't know how they managed to do this, but they were able to take that entire village and trace everybody's sexual contacts out. And they basically mapped them out. And when the rate of sexual partners was let's say that this person has a relationship with this person who has a relationship with that, and that there's like some connection. So I can't remember the specifics, but it was like when the rate of sexual partners was like 1.2, these groups where people were connected sexually were separated. But once it went to like 1.5, the entire village was connected sexually. The entire village. That everybody in that village was connected to everybody else sexually. And it was all on the number of sexual partners. So a number of sexual partners is a very crucial way to decrease HIV. And obviously from a Christian perspective, advocate marriage, but in terms of biologically, it makes a huge difference in decreasing that. And there's also an issue that happens in many places where it is sequential partners versus concurrent partners. When you have sequential, like you have one boyfriend, you go to number three, and you go from partner to partner, is one thing. But if you have a wife at home, and then you are at the same time having other partners, you know, there's now a connection between all. And in this case, you know, I don't know if that makes sense to you, but concurrent partners versus sequential partners also makes a big difference in terms of HIV transmission.
Is the percentage, is it a higher risk when you have sequential partners as opposed to
concurrent partners?
Concurrent
is a higher risk. Because you're coming back to the same person, so you go, yeah.
Because person three there is actually attached to person one and two because of the that they have in common, the wife at home.
Right. Well, one of the things that happens too is one of the times that the person is most able to transmit HIV is during the acute HIV infection, because during the acute HIV infection, which we can talk about if we have time, their viral load is really high. And so here, if someone if this is acute HIV infection and then passes the virus, you can very rapidly pass HIV acutely through all those because they've got high viral loads. After that acute infection, the viral load tends to drop. So it's in terms of timing, it's more complex for this lecture, but the idea is a lot of that, those dynamics, if you plot them out, make a big difference. And bottom line is, if you have one partner, it really makes a huge difference in HIV prevention. There's an approach in Uganda that's called the ABC approach, be abstinent, you know, until marriage. And if you can't be abstinent, be faithful to one partner. If you can't be faithful, then use condom. And there's, because politically, there's a lot of, you know, political groups that advocate the C, and a lot of political groups that advocate the A, the B is actually very important in terms of dynamics of what goes on. Decreasing number of sexual partners.
This is probably a dumb question, but does using the lubricant like cut down on blood or something like that? Or what's the deal with, why does a water-based lubricant decrease?
Well, the issue with the water-based lubricant is opposed to the oil-based lubricant. When you use an oil-based lubricant, it breaks down the integrity of the condom. It makes the condom porous if you use an oil-based lubricant.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Do not use oil-based condoms. Polyurethane condoms. And then, in terms of needles, there's a lot of hepatitis C in North Philadelphia, a lot of heroin use, and someone can be very consistent at using new needles, but all it takes is one needle. Needles are a very rapid way because it's deep penetration in the hollow bore of the needle where HIV resides. And we have a lot of patients that have hepatitis C and HIV. Very common. How much do I have time? How much more time?
It's 3:25, so like another 2 minutes.
Okay. I'm going to just maybe skip ahead to some other slides here. Meanwhile, if you have a question, if you're thinking about it.
I do have a question regarding, although this would not be me, but the spread of HIV in using needles and tattoo parlors. Is that the assumption that the needles are not disinfected or?
Right. The original question is, can it happen? And yes, if the needles are not properly disinfected, a lot of tattoo parlors, I haven't been to one, but from what I understand, they use clean equipment. But one concern is because sometimes the ink, you know, whether that can be a source, especially more of Hep C than HIV. Because, like I said, hepatitis C virus is much more stable outside the body, but there are people that do tattoos at home, and you know, but it's any kind of penetrating, it's a type that can, whether it does is another question.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And the other issue, too, that is a concern is that when, for hepatitis C specifically, if you go to a barbershop and someone shaves your neck and that razor is not properly treated, it's possible to transmit hepatitis C sharing that razor.
Oh, right. Yeah. So not right.
So let's skip ahead here.
That's interesting, since that's a common practice. Yeah. I mean, that's a real common practice, at least in African American barbershops. That's a very common practice. Yeah. You know, to shave the back of your neck.
Right. I've been to a lot of places where they would, disinfectant, they clean the razor, but they need to make sure that they do that. So the immune system prevents viruses, bacteria, and fungus from affecting. When that immune system breaks down, then those organisms attack the body. So when someone dies of HIV, they don't die of the virus, but they die of those opportunistic infections. So the immune system functions as this barrier. Let's skip ahead. And specifically attacks CD4 cells. CD4 cells play a very important role in the immune system. They are like the quarterbacks. So it would be like a football offense without the quarterbacks. You still have the other players. You take out a critical player, the whole system doesn't work because they help direct the attack. And so that's why when we were talking about earlier, knowing what is your proportion of CD4 cell really says which side is winning in terms of where your CD4 is. Something is really important too is during those 10 years that your patient doesn't have symptoms, there's a fallacy in thinking the virus is dormant, and that's really not true. This virus, within 2 hours of the person becoming infected, is producing millions of viruses. And over those 10 years, there's an incredible battle between the virus and the immune system, but the immune system is able to keep it in check. Eventually, it wears out the immune system, and then that's when you get late stage. But it's fallacy to think that it's dormant. It's very active.
Because if it was dormant for 10 years, what would ever make it active?
Right. As it wears out the system.
Do CD4 cells direct attack against the AIDS virus itself? Are there parts of the immune system that focus on killing the AIDS virus?
The natural killer cells are an important part of it, but they function in a general aspect in the immune system in any type of infection. There are other ones specifically. Okay, find another slide. There's another one on here that. Sorry about that. Okay. Okay, this is a good slide that we can do. Okay, so the normal number of CD4 cells in 1 cubic centimeter of blood is between 500 to 1500. Okay, so that's the normal range. When someone first becomes infected, after they get over the acute infection, they're going to have a normal number of CD4 cells. Without treatment, this number starts to go down. Once it goes below 200, that's what's considered AIDS, when that number drops below 200.
And there's no recovery from that at that point? There's no going with, back above?
No, with treatment, I've had patients that start out with 7, CD4 count of 7, now up to close to 500. So you can come out of that with treatment, but if you don't have treatment...
But it's still considered AIDS at that point, though, because it's dipped down to that 0 to 200 level.
Right, exactly. So it's important to understand also... this dynamic that takes place when... I'm going to make a line right here. This right here is 12 weeks. This is the first 12 weeks of infection. When someone is going through this acute infection, their CD4 count drops. They might get really sick here. Their viral load goes up high. This is when this person is very able to infect other people. This is before they really even know that they're positive, but they just got infected within these 12 weeks. After this 12 weeks, the immune system sort of figures out ways to keep it under control. Your CD4 count goes back up, and then from here to there can be 2 years, can be 10 years. A lot of it depends on that patient's immune system. And it's interesting, too, that that period in this country tends to be 10 years, and in the developing world can be 2 years, because people are more malnourished, the immune system isn't able to keep up for that amount of time. So this period, it varies dramatically depending on patients. And I've got, there's also a 1% of patients that are called long-term non-progressives. These are patients, I've got one that's positive since 1986, and never been on any medications, and he's got good numbers. They're 1% of HIV positive patients, but there's a certain number of patients whose immune system is able to keep this in check. And those patients are very of great interest to researchers as to why that person, that 1%, can be off of medication for so long.
Vaccination works with a lot of disease where you take dead cells of the virus or bacteria, put it in, and then the body recognizes it and is able to fight it. How come that doesn't work for AIDS?
The HIV vaccine is a huge interest in terms of trying to cure the disease. I'm going to actually just go through this quickly, and then I'll answer that question, and then we'll finish up and pass it through. So asymptomatic and then in late stages is where these numbers cross. But your question is a very interesting answer. Okay. Part of why HIV is so difficult to cure, and part of why the vaccine is difficult to develop, is a special kind of cell called the CD4 memory cell. These cells provide memory for our immune system. When something comes up later, they remember it. So HIV equally infects these cells as well as it infects regular CD4 cells. And in an active cell, the HIV virus is able to replicate, but the memory cell, some of them just remain dormant, so there's no activity going on inside the cell, but the HIV virus is in there. So what happens, this explains part of why you can have a patient, you give them treatment, their viral load, which is the amount of virus in the system, goes to zero for 4 years. You know, you completely stop viral replication. All the HIV medications today, there's about 24 of them, impact, like some prevent the virus from attaching. There's different steps inside here that these medications are aimed at, but they're all of them are aimed at stopping an active process. These medications aren't, there's nothing for the medication to do if there's no activity going on. There's no stop, there's no step to stop. So this patient can be on medications for 4 years, undetectable viral load. You take the medications away, viral load comes back. Well, where did it come back from if the person was at zero for 4 years? And part of it is it, from time to time, these memory cells wake up. And when they wake up, so does the viral replication process. And the virus comes back. So theoretically, you can cure someone of HIV if you treated them for 75 years, because the life, the maximum lifetime of one of these cells is 75 years. So that's part of why also the vaccines are very difficult. What they're looking in terms of the vaccines is a vaccine that would stimulate the immune system in such a way that when these do wake up, that it would stimulate an attack, but it hasn't been successful yet.
Interesting. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? I'll give you some time.
It's so unfair to come after Rob. He's so good, but it's obviously important to understand the medical background of HIV and AIDS, but I think as Christians, we need to be able to understand, and I like what you said, to just understand, and also with you, to kind of what I hear from you is to meet people where they are, and to do that, we need to understand about the disease. But I love the scripture found in 2 Corinthians 1:4 that says, "Comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort we ourselves have received from God." And, you know, when you look into Micah, I think we, as Christians, are fixated on Micah 6:8. We kind of rush right to the 8th verse. And the 6th verse are really the people of God asking God really sarcastically, "What do you want from me? You want a sacrifice? You want my oxen? You want my cattle? What do you want?" You know, and he answers in a very strong way. And when you look at that language that he is, what is required? It's not many times that he used those strong word in
in his work, and it says, this is what we require, we are to act with justice, to love and give mercy, and to walk rightly and humbly with our God. And so if you do unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. And that's what God requires. HIV, unfortunately, is alive and well today. The largest group of people living with the virus in the good old red, white, and blue USA and around the world are women of color. 25 years ago, it was white, gay, middle class men. So how do you go from white, middle class, gay men to... We can talk about it, and Rob alluded to it, to the numbers. They're looking at the concentrated areas of outbreaks with San Francisco, New York, looking at those things. And when I used to walk in Graduate Hospital, which was the first and only hospital in Philadelphia, which is now closed, it was kind of, I had to have a moment of silence for Graduate Hospital because they were so radical and welcomed people in when they didn't know how it was transmitted, what it was. They just said, come, you know. It's a lot of reasons why that is. You could say it's because women are more promiscuous, men are being honest about who they are sexually or as individuals. But ultimately, it's hitting every area of the human population. That's the largest group of people living with HIV around the world. In America, two young people between the ages of 13 and 22 every hour become positive with HIV. So two young people, and there's 24 hours in a day, so two times 24, 7 days a week, you know, we can go on and on and on. Young people are fast increasing. The largest body of people percentage-wise is, anyone take a guess?
Age-wise?
No, percentage of people becoming infected with HIV. Not in numbers, but in percentage. Senior citizens.
What?
Senior citizens. Why do you think that is? One of the main causes. Right. Percentage. Not in numbers, but percentage.
Senior citizens.
Mm-hmm. What they do is 55 and over.
The percentage of living elderly people has doubled or is growing so much quicker than it was in the past.
Right. But a little pill call?
Oh, Viagra.
There's a new lease on life, too. Oh. And so now you have a 60-year-old man who can relive his prep college days. You know. So those are some indicators, not always in that. That's a whole other workshop of what that comes up to. But in every segment of our population in the human, it's being affected. I'm ashamed to say that as Christians, at least when I got into it, and I volunteered about 4 or 5 years before I actually began the work 15 years ago, Christians were kind of taking the fall over, just from the pit of hell, this is God's judgment, it's for, you know, upon the gays and homosexual. Well, I feel like that's true. I needed to get in line because, you know, I believe our heart is wicked and deceitful, but by the grace and blood of Jesus Christ that was shed for us, we would all be doomed to damnation, but by his grace. So, it's really hitting all our areas. I have the privilege of going every other week to the Youth Study Center right across from Whole Foods, for those that know the Art Museum area. And it's a detention for or holding place for youth between the ages of 13 and 18. And I particularly go around each time I come and I start off as, what is sex? And you would not believe the answers. What is sex? Case in point, when we were at Hope, we had a young lady come to us when I was working at Hope Ministry who came and said, I'm a virgin, but I'm having all these symptoms. I don't know what to do. My grandmother heard about you. Help me. So we put her in touch with the doctor, did all that, got tested, came back positive. No way I can be positive. I'm a virgin. Didn't use drugs. Didn't, you know, we went on and on. And I sat down with her, talking to her, and I said, well, we need to be honest. Now we have a positive diagnosis. Need to really be honest with me. And I got a sense that she was telling the truth, but it just didn't pan out from what she was telling me from the diagnosis. And finally I said, well, what is your, my grandmother always used to tell me, I'll just be frank. She said, oh, my grandmother always used to tell me, don't let a boy put his pee pee in my VV. And then it hit me. I said, have you ever let a boy put his pee pee in your bum bum? Oh yeah, all the time, but I'm still a virgin. And we, even when we sent her to a gynecologist, it was obvious that she was a virgin. But in her mind, her definition of sex, so she could party and have fun and not knowing that what sex is. I mean, still at 17, 18 year olds, you say, like Rob was saying about oral sex, what? Oh, really? I never knew that. Oh, I'm not having sex. I'm like, is this Bill Clinton? What's going on? You know, there's no kind of strong definition of what's going on. So we have to, when ministering and when talking to people about HIV, you have to deal, it's in some ways so closely tied to sex. What is sex and who are you? I was asked to do a workshop on a listening workshop for students at University City, and they kept apologizing. There'll probably only be two or three there on gender confusion or people who are students who are kind of wrestling with this. And there were 15. The guidance counselor couldn't believe it. It was just 15 in a safe place, a place in the room, in the side of the school no one really goes to, where kids could sit and talk about, I don't know, I like both. I like being with men and women. I like this. You know, there's all these different areas of what is sex, who are you, what are you doing? And the reality is that God calls us. He requires us to love and give mercy, to walk humbly with God, and to do justice, to seek after justice, but it's also to meet people where they are. And so if you really desire, and the Lord's put on your heart, that when HIV knocks on your door in any way, shape, or form, through your church, through a neighbor, through whatever, you have to be willing to really go to these places and maybe even have these discussions. I handed out a sheet that goes, and we have a whole manual and a whole thing that talks about communication, that talks about many different things. The basic understanding of HIV and AIDS, statistics, myths, phobias, and truths, the role of Christian support, perspectives on death and dying, legal issues, and all those other things. And I encourage you, there's some the basic main information here, and then on the back there's communication skills that you can take. But I think this whole issue of meeting people where they are and understanding that we're to be light in the darkness. I remember one time we had a patient, a guy who wanted a buddy, and we kind of tried to link them up. We educated and trained our buddies through workshops and through conferences and through studying one-on-one, and we couldn't really find a good volunteer to go with the patient. And then finally the director said, well, what about this guy? He's like, Greg, are you kidding me? Every word out of his mouth is scripture, which is great, unless you're really trying to have a conversation. How are you doing it? Well, as in Psalm says, this is. And I was like, and this guy was very powerful in the HIV/AIDS community. He's in the top three shaker and movers, and he was very honest and he was very blunt. I don't believe that Christians really can give the gift of mercy to people with HIV. So guess what? I have HIV. I'm in the last stages. I'm hospice, you're going to come, I'm going to become a client of yours, and you're one, my one rule is not to mention Jesus or God or anything spiritual. And there were some of our board of directors, members of our board that said, no, we are Christian, we need to be bold, we need to be light, we need to go and share the gospel with him, get his soul saved, and said no. And we linked him up with Greg, who was, you know, going for his master's right here at Westminster Seminary. I mean, when you walk into his house and you see his library of theology books, you're like, whoa. You know, he just loves it. And we say, Greg, guess what? You get to use all that theology you know and put it into action without speaking it. And he's like, what? And this is real important because this guy is best friends with PGN editor. There will be a whole write-up of everything we're saying. It's time for you to actually use your theology and act it out. And it was the roughest beginning I've ever seen. Give me another round, you know. And it just worked out to be really beautiful. The man, 3 days before he died, he asked Greg, finally he said, okay, what's going on? I'll not forget, it was University of Penn. I was sitting in the corner, kind of sleeping, because we were kind of watching over until his family came. And he said, just tell him, what is it? Okay, give me your spiel. And Greg, I was like, oh no, I can see him. You know, he was reformed. Total depravity. You know, I was like, no. And he did it so beautifully. Just talked about Jesus as a savior, as a comforter, as a redeemer, as a liberator. Gave his personal testimony, which Greg didn't really feel like there's enough testimonies in the Bible. We don't need to give our personal verbiage about what God's done for us. And he just gave his own personal in such a beautiful way. And I remember the gentleman just saying, I'm going to think about it. I'm going to think about it. And when you come tomorrow, we'll talk more. And, you know, his family came, we left. In the middle of the night, he went to a coma and died 3 days later. We never knew. And that was also a good place for Greg, because it wasn't like, you know, I come to the cross now. We don't know. But Greg had to live out his theology, and he had to be a light in the midst of darkness, and he had to consistently show up. So there's some practical things we can do. I'm going to go over some kind of do's and don'ts. It's important to do when ministering to people or being a Christian support. You know, obviously remember their people with an illness and treat them as you wanted to be treated. Remember, body language gives a lot. You know, standing and say, tell me about your life. Well, does it seem like I really want to hear about it? Like, yeah, I really want to hear about what you're doing and, you know, how everything's going. Body language. You know, find things in common to talk about. I know these are kind of obvious things, but I think when you're in situations where there's where you're fearful of the unknown, I think we need to be reminded about that. Talk about the future. That was one of the hardest things for me to do, because I guess I had seen so many deaths. It was kind of hard. I thought, oh, we lead them down a road of, you know, misplaced hope. But say, you know, what do you think spring will be like? Or what are you hoping to do tomorrow or next month? This encourages the attitude of living. Never, ever, ever ask, unless you're a medical profession, how you got the disease. You know, say, hey, hi, Manny. How'd you get that again? You know, just, you know, don't ever ask. Let them. That is a huge trust point, because you will gain trust if you just accept their diagnosis, walk alongside of them, and then allow them to tell you in their own way. And over time. So that is a huge no. And, you know, and just obviously don't preach to them. Be explained for, like, with anyone else, unexpected mood change. And just remember who you're there representing. On the back is communication, so I won't go over that. You can look at that. Just obvious things like open-ended questions. The main thing is showing up in the rough places. I've had the wonderful honor and privilege of working with Calcutta House for over 10 years. And I'm telling you, the reason why they love me, buzz me in without me, you know, let me roam the place, do whatever I want, treat it like a second home, is because I showed up when it got tough. I showed up when there was a diaper needed to be changed. I showed up when no one was there. I showed up. And I'm not patting myself on the head, but you want trust that the first crisis, even if it's fearful, even if you bring your spouse or bring someone else, that is the key to show up in the dark times, to show up in the dark places. It's really, really important, because that really speaks to them. And again, it touches on the, touches you. And don't let everything be associated around, you know, obviously HIV and AIDS. You know, you can go for a walk. You don't have to say, hey, there's an AIDS symposium down at University of Penn. You want to go? You know, maybe it'll be better just to go to a movie, you know. Things like that. Another thing is to, you know, always call and ask, okay, if it's okay to visit. Just don't assume, well, they need me. I'll be there. They always let your friend make the decision. Talk about their different views. Always take a nugget of the conversation you hear and always remember it another time. That is confirming to them that you're listening. Another thing is to, as in, you know your own weaknesses, hopefully, and your own boundaries. One thing is, I do not love. I love movies. I can be a little snotty and snobbish about it, but I love European movies because I think the dialogue's much better, the production's better, There's not always a pretty face, you know, there's, you know. But one thing I just don't like, because I always, as a child, had to go down into the basement of this 1890-something house, and it just was spooky movies. I don't like spooky movies at all. And so we just got this new patient who's actually at Calcutta House, and we got along great. He says, come on over. Someone told me you like movies. I said, really? And he said, oh, they told me all about it. And he sat there, and they had told him, the nurse had told him, oh, Ruth likes movies, but not spooky movies. Well, he had, like, Freddy Krueger. And he sat there, and it was a test. Am I important spending more time with me or watching Freddy Krueger? So that's not as much as a thriller or a slasher, you know, movies. But anyway, I sat there. Now, my own thing would be like, I'm not going to submit myself to this. I don't know. No, that has no plot, you know. But I just sat there, and then the next time he got a real true suspense thriller, you know, and we went on. And then I said, I want this friendship to be equal. And after the third movie, I want you to watch a movie. Well, why? It's my room. No. I said, I want, our friendship is equal. It's about, I want to learn who you are, but hopefully you're kind of interested in who I am too.
All right.
You know, and then we went back and forth. And one week it was more, you know, suspense slasher movies. And the other one was more, you know, artsy fartsy, you know, movies. So also think clearly, even before you get involved, boundaries that you would want to do. Obviously, like, if it's like, I like porn, you want to watch, you know, I would be like, well, that might not be the best thing for me. So think about those things, too. And then also, you know, I think your loved ones, like when I first got married, my husband just finally said, my dream in life was to have a late-stage AIDS baby, because at that time, we at Hope, we were dealing with 4 or 5, and I just thought, it's intense, it's hard, but it doesn't go too long. So I want to give the last year or 2 years of an infant's life or a toddler's life, this caring home. And he just said to me, it was like, he just said, Ruth, you will forget everyone else. You will abandon your family. You will abandon everything. This child will be an idol. And it was true. I wasn't, as much as I loved working with people, I was not balanced enough to do it. So check with your friends and say, can I be a friend to this? Do you think I can handle it? Do you think this is good? So those are just some of the kind of common sense things to do. As a church committee, it would be good to have a support team. So even if it's a prayer, I'm not saying organize an AIDS group in your church and then go out. That would be great. I would love that, personally. But if not, have someone else accountability where you go to. And then don't become the savior. That was probably one of the hardest things I've learned, was not to be a savior to the person. Also be wise, particularly, like I remember there were 2 instances. This is Uta Bartholomew. She was our top volunteer at Hope Ministry when we were dealing with death and dying, and at this point it started off, they had 6 months to live. As Rob was saying, early on the convert, there wasn't 10 years. You became infected. By the time you found out you were infected, you converted to full-blown AIDS 6 feet under. And so the toughest thing we were called to do was the last season of the life. And at a long period would be probably a year, but at the beginning it was 2 months, 3 months. So you're dealing with rage, you're dealing with regret, you're dealing with lost of life, everything. No family, no money was the main thing. And so we would have volunteers who would be a buddy. And I'm telling you, after one instance, one, you know, assignment, they would be, great, did it, God bless you, I'm out. Uta reassigned up, I think, 7 times?
6 times all told.
Just kept, one time we were like, don't you want a little sabbatical? But she kept showing up. The one thing I would say, but I look back on those years and say I was so naive. I remember 2 instances, so be wise, especially if the person's isolated, living alone. There's other things that Rob could tell you that can happen at the late stage, sometimes with neurologically, with other things. You have to take care of yourself. It's not that you're being me central, but be wise. I remember one time I went in with our director, Ken, to visit at 8th and Spruce, nice neighborhood, you know, and we were doing a death watch. And Ken got a call, had an emergency, had to go to another situation. And to say this guy woke up and went crazy. I mean, just crazy. Swinging a bat. And I was like, should I stay? And I want him to hurt himself. And finally something said, out. You know, and I went out.
called the place, and you know, they took him to graduate, and we worked it all out. But it was no one at the time, even his doctor, when we met, had realized that neurologically some things had really changed. Another time, I think Uda went up 2-1, and it was just, you know, it was just a very unsanitary situation where there was human feces, rats, roaches, everything, you know. So we stayed and helped so much, but that's not the time to be the savior of the world. It's to come in, go back and get a support group or get someone else and come in and together as a unit. Another one time was really safe where I was going to do a death watch because the mother worked at night. So I would go, and he was actively dying, this man. I mean, it was a matter of time. And I would sit. And she left. And all of a sudden, I heard the cellar door open, and I heard all this commotion. I went downstairs, and here was a brother. They never told me about the crazy brother. Seriously, like, crazy brother. He blocked the door. He had the fireplace poker thing and was wielding it and yelling things that didn't have, you know, probably a good outcome for me. And I couldn't believe it. The man got off of the bed and crawled and said, told him. And he stopped. Everyone was amazing that this man on his deathbed literally was able to crawl to the foot of the stairs and say, leave her alone. And he went down and he shut it. So I just didn't even think about that, you know. So just be wise, no matter how much the great need, just be wise. One other thing is, one of Rob knows, a client that's dear to me is a transgendered client, love, I call her out of respect of how she wants to be identified, to death, but I cannot let her know where I live. It has been the source of so much frustration, deep pain, rejection, everything in her life, just because I know there's some other mental health issues. So I cannot let her know where I live. And I understand where she's coming from, but that's the last kernel of true acceptance for her, that you allow me to come and sit at your dinner table and eat. And I just can't. I have children. I have a husband. There's been times where I've done so. No matter how much the pleading, just, you know, continue to be wise. Yes?
Just real quick, the practical note, one of the things I even do for business is have a voicemail number for $11 a month that people can call 24/7. I check it once, twice, three times a day. But no, those people who get that number never call to my house and have a possibility of me picking up the phone. It'll let me know when the best time to get in touch with them. But it's a barrier, but it's also a means of communication. And that really makes a difference for me, even in terms of work.
Yeah. I've had the same one for 20-some years. It's called a floating voicemail. It's about $11. I mean, unless you're getting like 100 calls, it just is about $11 a month. And it's just good to have a number so you're giving them a sense of, here's my number, here's a voice message, you know, things like that. Are there any questions, any practical ways? I know that some of you are coming from different aspects, your interest, anything in your, like, day-to-day or going forward that will be helpful for you in kind of empowering and mobilizing yourselves or the Christian community and giving the gift of light in Jesus to the HIV positive?
You know, we live in the suburbs. I mean, if anybody came to us with that problem and answered it, so we wouldn't even know where to begin to go to look for services. Mm-hmm. We'll be a good starting place.
Well, yes. I think Esperanza is amazing. Like I said, I worked for Hope Ministry before, but we were more a central place where we gathered. You need medical, okay. You need social, you need financial, and we gathered and helped resource. And again, concentrated on the death and dying, the hospice area. But one thing that I loved about Esperanza is that they were a full HIV department that addressed every social need, every need that you have, whether counseling, food, I mean, social work, medical, everything. So would you mind writing just the number? I would encourage you all to copy down the name of that, the center.
Do they keep their number on them?
Yes. And there's a whole HIV department that'll be able to help you. Also, I'll put mine down if you just want, like, a You know, you're like, well, I don't want to really do it.
What's the whole thing? Runs it out. What's the location?
Yes, like pink.
Thanks for feeling safe enough with us that you gave us your phone number.
No problem at all.
It could be her voicemail. The floating voicemail.
Yeah. Like I said, there's a whole bee finder. If you're interested in receiving one or going into more deep, please feel free to call me. There's more ways to go, and I know it's like, is it five after already?
Ooh.
Five after, so I don't want to take more times. I want to end with this one thing. The thing that has, in times, I've been, you know, very discouraged from time to times. I have to say, give me Calcutta House any day over the youth study detention, because one is at the end. Not the end, but one is in the midst of the living. One is prevention that I do at Youth Study Center, and I just cannot believe. You know, like one guy just said to me, I could walk out here when they let me out and get hit by a Mack truck. I don't want any barrier to, and he was very articulate, any barrier to my pleasure. So if I get HIV, at least I got 10 years. And I just thought, if I could have dragged him and sat him down and showed him all, I've kept every funeral program, and what percentage of those were young people, you know. So, but the things that have encouraged me, and I want to end on this note, is really what Jesus says, and it's surrounded by all these parables of the 10 virgins, parable of the sheep and goats, but it's in Matthew 25th chapter, and the 36th verse, and it says, "For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger invite you in, or needing clothes and clothing? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did it for me." And when I think of like our worship and our praise and how we can adore our great God, but we can physically, in our own way, in obedience with God's calling on our life to do this, because this is not something to enter into lightly. And we know the voice and we know that urge, I'm sure all of you do. When that opportunity, and if that opportunity presents itself, we have a chance to do it to Jesus, to wipe the brow, to wipe away the tears, to hold a hand, to change a diaper, to do whatever. We have a chance to do it to the great King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and more importantly, the one who is willing to give up his life for us. And so if that happens, Rob is available, Esperanza is available, I'm available, to walk alongside you and help you in any way we can. So there's a lot more information. We do whole day conferences on these things. So I hope that's been just the tip of the iceberg enough information for you.
I came in late, so I don't know if you covered this enough, but did you talk about like in other countries, like is it still rapidly growing? Is there any decrease? Is it?
Yeah, it's still growing in worldwide. There's areas in the world, especially China and Asia, where the percentages are growing rapidly. There's still a big problem with IV drug use in Eastern Europe. Lots of.
Is it the lack of education, or they just don't want to believe what they hear?
Well, I think it's HIV. If you look at the tree model, it's a fruit. It's really not necessarily. There's a lot of broken families, it's a lot of broken communities, a lot of, you know, I think it's not just education, there's a lot of brokenness that leads people down those paths, and yeah, it's not a simple answer, but I think that in terms of responsibility of church becoming involved, I think one of the issues, one of the things you mentioned is what happens when someone who's HIV positive shows up, we wouldn't necessarily know how to handle them. And I think I would spin around if they're likely at your church. And you know, the patients that we see, we've got pastors, and their whole congregation doesn't know if they're positive. Mm-hmm. We know. You know, there's a lot of people, because the disease is treatable, a lot of people, you know, you can't tell by looking at someone. And so I think it is, you know, even in, you know, if any of your churches are interested in a talk about HIV, be glad to go and talk about it, to begin those discussions about, it's in our own backyard, but around the world there's lots of, there's books written about ways to prevent HIV in communities from a community standpoint.
I remember I met with the pastor, and he said, "Well, Ruth, this has been great. When HIV comes to my church, I'll give you a call." And he didn't know his assistant pastor was a client of ours, you know. And I just thought, that's all.
You were saying,
really. Also, just culturally, I think it's important too to know worldwide. There's so many cultural issues. I know when I was in Kenya, Nakuru, we had a women's conference. And one woman came up to me and said, "I'm going to get a beating when I go home because I wasn't supposed to come, but I needed to come so I at least can try and protect myself against my husband, who his job involved traveling. I probably suspected he was a driver, professional driver, truck driver or something." And she said, "I just want to try. It may be too late for me, but I want to help my daughter." And so she was going to get a beating because he was going to find out she's been gone all day and not working the field. So there's all sorts of... One, they were celebrating when I was there. In another part of Kenya, that the law now, you can go when your husband beats you and tell you. But we went to the police department. Let me tell you, there's no way I would go and report because it's just this man, you know, they passed the law, but it doesn't matter because there are four guys and they're all friends. So you go and say, "Mr. Policeman, my husband beat me." And they're like, "Oh, okay, well, hey, your wife was here today. She would have done it. Don't worry, we didn't even write up the paperwork." So it's still these, you know, these are the things that don't make the news. There are also many cultural issues. People that believe, like even with violence, there's parts that believe if you have sex with a virgin, you get rid of it. So you have raping them. It's just, it goes beyond education. It's cultural too. It's just, it's a lot.